You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
This week on Dear Science, we are joined once again by our expert, Professor Alan Blackman. Good afternoon.
Word always makes me laugh. Hi, Castor. Hi, Yosef.
Yeah, lots of science today. An especially exciting event we've got here. Look forward to all year round. What are the Ig Nobel Science Awards?
The Ig Nobel Prizes. Well, we all know about the Nobel Prizes. And then in 1991, a guy by the name of Mark Abraham thought it'd be a good idea to... Yeah, well, as he says, award a series of prizes for achievements that first make people laugh and then make them think.
Yes.
So, sort of the lighter side of science, I guess, but with a serious sort of undertow, shall we say.
Right, and that's what we're all about, honestly.
Absolutely. Mm. And so these were first awarded in 1991.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the day, and they were originally held at MIT, and then they moved to Harvard, and now they're back at MIT, and apparently it was the first in-person award for 4 years since the whole COVID thing and everything,
wow.
So they're back and in person. And so here's a few things about the Ig Nobel Prizes. So unlike the Nobel Prizes, there's no set award categories, so they just sort of make them up on the fly. And again, in contrast to the Nobel Prizes, there are around about 10,000 people nominated annually.
Wow. This is in hot contention, folks.
Which is way more than the Nobel Prizes.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, your research doesn't have to be done in the last sort of year or two or anything like that. It can be all the way back, as we'll see today. Some of it dates back at least sort of 60 years. And if you win this, and people do want to win this, if you win this, you have to pay your own way to the ceremony.
In classic fashion. I mean, that makes sense.
So without further ado, I mean, what, we had the Emmys yesterday, so...
Yeah, who cares about those, though, right? Indeed. When we've got the Ig Nobel Prizes here.
Right, so without further ado, I think some of the humour about this is that the titles of these papers are very, very sort of deadpan, and you don't really see the funny side until it's... Explain. So the Peace Prize was won by B.F. Skinner from the USA, and he won that for experiments to see the feasibility of housing live pigeons inside missiles to guide the flight paths of the missiles.
That's very good. Right.
And this is kind of interesting because this was a kosher World War II trial.
It actually sounds, you know, maybe it's plausible.
Pigeons are pretty smart.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, and you know, they had them sort of pecking at a screen or something like that. That was the whole thing to keep this missile on target, apparently. And as I say, it was proposed at least in World War II, but it was classified until 1960. So this paper didn't come out until 1960. The Botany Prize was won by workers in Germany, Brazil, and the USA. And so the title of the paper that won this is Bochila trifoliolata mimics leaves of an artificial plastic host plant. And basically, what this is saying is that they found evidence that some real plants imitate the shapes of neighbouring artificial plastic plants.
That's really cool.
Oh my God, they're like false beauty standards, but for plants.
That's so cool. Oh, yes, I can finally give my tree body dysmorphia.
It'll never be like the plants in the magazines.
Sorry.
Oh, very, very good, very good. But... then this raises the very, very serious question, how do they know?
How does the plant?
How does plant know what the plastic
plant
looks like?
Do we know how the plant knows?
Well, the authors have proposed a thing called plant vision.
So plants can see a little bit?
Well, I don't know. But, you know, this is one way of explaining this.
That's absolutely incredible.
And, you know, this is serious research. This you know, this has been published in a peer-reviewed journal, as have all of these. That's the thing. This is real science. Okay?
That's incredible.
The Anatomy Prize, and this went to workers in France and Chile, and, do we know the Coriolis effect? Have we heard of the Coriolis effect?
I've heard of it, but I couldn't tell you what it is.
Okay, well, it's related to, if you're in the Northern Hemisphere, the water goes down the plug hole one way, and if you're in the Southern Hemisphere, the water goes down the plug hole apparently the opposite way, and if you're on the equator, then apparently it just goes straight down.
That makes sense.
Okay.
Yep.
And this has been either absolutely confirmed or absolutely debunked, depending on who you believe.
Right.
Okay. So these workers asked the very, very pertinent question, is the same thing or does the same thing happen with the whorls on your hair?
Oh. Okay.
So you know what we mean by a whorl? W-H-O-R-L.
Yes.
Okay, so your hair sort of spirals. Okay, it comes out of one sort of, some people anyway. So it comes out on your head in a spiral. And so the question is, are those spirals hemisphere dependent? So
yes.
Do we go clockwise in the northern hemisphere and anti-clockwise in the southern hemisphere?
Yeah, I need to know now.
And the answer is counterclockwise whorls are more frequent in the southern hemisphere.
That's incredible.
Go figure.
Wow. Like this is the sort of thing where it's like a question I'd never even contemplated asking.
Yeah,
but now I urgently need to find out.
And again, the title of the paper sort of doesn't really... So, genetic determinism and hemispheric influence in hair whorl formation. It doesn't really sort of put across the...
going on there,
It's almost kind of like massive in a way, because if you're like, you see the stranger and you haven't spoken, you want to know where they're from, you're like, can you come a bit closer, please? Can you see the top of your
hair?
May
I investigate your hair? That's really good.
And, you know, again, I stress this is research that is done by people at universities and published in reputable, you know, scientific journals.
Mm.
So, right, we go to the Medicine Prize. And the Medicine Prize this year was won by workers from Switzerland, Germany and Belgium. This sort of gives it away. The title of the paper, How Side Effects Can Improve Treatment Efficacy, a Randomized Trial.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, what they did was they demonstrated basically that fake medicine that causes painful side effects is more effective than fake medicine that does not cause painful side effects.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah. Oh, that's really... Because of the... that makes sense.
That's kind of believable, eh? Like, sometimes you, like, take, like, that, like, the nasal medication, you kind of feel it stinging your nose, but it's like, oh, now I know my nose is being unblocked.
Well, that's how chiropractors work, right?
No, chiropractors don't work.
Well, no. So they give you the painful side effects on the medicine that doesn't work, and then you believe that it works.
Oh boy, they'll be texting in now.
Sorry.
Oh,
sorry to any chiropractors.
No. Now, funny you should say nasal, because that's the way that they did this, okay?
Mm-hmm.
What they did was they got a nasal spray, and so they told these participants that the nasal spray contained fentanyl, okay? Potent painkiller.
Yes, yeah.
And then what they did was they apparently gave them a bit of sort of heat treatment. So they put a hot thing on their skin or something like that and measured their pain.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, the trick was that the nasal spray didn't in fact contain fentanyl.
Nothing at all.
Well, not in fact, nothing at all. Mm-hmm. One of them was saline. the other one contained capsaicin, okay, which is your chilies. Okay.
Yep.
That's your hot stuff in your
chilies.
A little
bit of spice there.
Obviously, you stick that up your nose, you're going to,
ouch.
There's a side effect for you. There's a painful side effect. So that's the way that they did it. So this was sort of a randomized trial, and they didn't know which one they were getting, but they were all told that it contained fentanyl.
Mm.
Okay. And then those who got the capsaicin obviously thought,
I mean, I'm nodding because I'm like, this would work on me.
Yeah.
I mean, I would take the nose spray, I'd go, oh, yeah, that hurts. Cool.
Yeah, that hurts, so it must be working.
Exactly.
Yeah, it makes
sense.
Yep. And so, as I said, they were then given heat pain stimuli and asked to rate their pain, and they're also given functional MRI as well. So, you know, this is hardcore.
Mm.
This is hardcore science.
This is dedicated research.
You know, you've got to pay for access to a functional MRI machine. Mm. So this is what they came up with, and that's a very, very interesting result.
I mean, that's incredible.
Yeah.
Absolutely nuts.
And actually, there was a recent paper where they were doing sort of something similar. They were looking at placebos, and they were actually telling the participants that they were getting a placebo.
Yes.
But they still worked.
It still worked. That's incredible.
Even when they knew they were getting a placebo.
The findings of this research have implications for the way we do placebos going forward?
Well, again, you know, are placebos ethical then?
Yeah. Is it ethical for me to
treatment?
Give you a pill that hurts you? Give you the spray that makes your nose hurt.
No, a whole host of ethical considerations.
But I mean, if it works.
Yes, yeah, yep.
Wow.
So, you know, the mind is an amazing thing. It just is.
That's
and we
incredible.
Know, you know, not the barest thing about it, really, if we're going to be brutally honest. So, on to the physics prize. And the physics prize, again, a pretty boring title, this one. Neuromuscular control of trout swimming in a vortex street. Implication for energy economy during the Kamman Gate. Whatever the heck that
what
is.
What that means is beyond me.
Right. Well, what it means is a dead fish can swim upstream if it is resonance with the vortices in the water. You can actually take a dead fish and provide it all if you've got exactly the right conditions.
And a dead fish can swim.
So it basically gets sucked along by the vortices in the water. Mm. You know how water vortexes.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you get that exactly right, mm-hmm. then you've got this fish that obviously rigor mortis hasn't set in yet, so it's still sort of flexible or whatever, and then it can sort of move its body in resonance with these vortices, and it sort of kind of gets sucked upstream.
That's incredible.
And they do that without expending energy, obviously, because
yeah, because it's dead. Maybe the alive fish should be tapping into this, swimming up the vortices in the water, the vortices.
So that's pretty cool. Mm. The physiology prize. Now, this one, okay, so again, the title does not give it away. Mammalian enteral ventilation ameliorates respiratory failure. There's a lot of big syllabic words.
And I suspect that's what they're trying to do as well, right?
And so these are workers from Japan and the USA. And this is really quite serious, this one, although it will give you a laugh. Basically, you can squirt oxygen up your bum and you can sort of breathe it, basically. That's essentially what it is. And the reason that they sort of looked at this was because of COVID.
Okay? Oh, because,
now,
yes.
They were running out of respirators, weren't they? Remember those days? Mm-hmm. Okay. And so they wanted another way of basically getting oxygen into you.
A little bit embarrassing.
Breathable oxygen.
Mm.
Okay. And so what they showed in both rodent and pig models was basically that if you put oxygen, okay, so you can dissolve oxygen in this thing called a fluorocarbon, a liquid fluorocarbon solvent, which is inert.
Mm-hmm.
And they showed that in rodent and pig models that you could insert this in the anus to give it its medical name, okay, and that oxygen then became available to your rodent or your pig, okay? And so therefore, excuse me, now, I'm not sure whether they have actually extended this to human subjects.
Yeah.
I don't yet know. But, again, you know, if this worked in human subjects, then that would have taken a lot of pressure off the...
I can imagine it might be a bit rubbish, though, right? Like, imagine getting to the hospital, they're like, sorry, we're out of respirators.
It's time for your oxygen enema.
Yeah, exactly, right? It's a bit of an unfortunate situation.
Yeah, see, they didn't mention the words oxygen enema in the title of the paper.
Yeah, that makes sense, actually.
Right, what have we got next? We've got the probability prize.
Ooh, okay. Exciting.
Workers from all around Europe here.
Mm-hmm.
This is interesting. Okay, so they basically found out that if they flipped a coin 350,757 times, there was a very, very slight probability above 50-50 that it would land on the same side that it started on.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Got it.
So instead of the probability of that happening being 0.500, which it should be, exactly a half.
Yeah, that makes sense, flipping a coin.
The probability was 0.508 that it would land on the same side as it started.
How does that even happen?
And even weirder, if you had a random arrangement of the coin to start off with.
Yes.
Then the heads-tails ratio was always exactly 0.500.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So that's what you expect for flipping a coin, that the heads-tail ratio has to be half, exactly half. But there seems to be a slight favorability for the side that it actually started on appearing.
Exactly at the...
Over this many flips. So, 350,757. It sounds like a big number.
Yeah.
When
you're running it through a computer, I assume. Or is it physical?
No, this apparently is physical.
Physical
this is,
flips,
yeah,
wow.
Yeah, this is physical flips.
Is this the hard-hitting life hack, I wonder now, if whenever someone's like, you're trying to do a coin flip...
Oh, yeah, gambler's fallacy like, is real once you get to the 300,000.
Can I see what side of the coin you're flipping from?
Well, okay, you do have a slight advantage. Got
to take any advantage you can get.
I mean, honestly, knowledge is the big advantage. Yeah, you know more now that you know this. Walk into the casino with confidence. Sorry, I should establish.
Walk into the casino with confidence.
I'm not encouraging gambling by any means.
So so there you go. Next time you're in a coin toss, pick the side.
The side that it was on 300,000 times ago.
Yep. Pick that side that it's on, you know, right now. Okay. Getting near the end now, the chemistry prize, the one that, you know, I'm particularly interested in, from the Netherlands and France. Okay. And the title of the paper, it does give you some idea, actually. Chromatographic separation of active polymer-like worm mixtures by contour length and activity. Or how to use chromatography to separate drunk and sober worms.
Oh, yeah. Okay. This is useful.
But it is remarkable.
Oh,
because
okay.
Because we're talking about polymers, okay? Polymers mm-hmm. are big, long molecules, yep. okay? And sometimes you have a need to separate those polymers,
mm-hmm.
okay? And we do it using a thing called chromatography, whereby you basically put these things in a solution and you put it through a thing that we call a column, which is basically filled with, it could be just silica, sand,
right.
those sorts of things. And so basically your little molecules have got to find their way through this big...
Like a coffee filter, really.
Same sort of thing.
Yeah.
And some do it better than others.
Mm.
So some go through faster than others, and so therefore you get a separation.
Mm.
Okay. And so they were looking at polymers, and they thought, okay, well, we could use worms to model polymers. God knows what made them think of that, okay?
Right, that makes sense. A worm is like a long cell.
So they were using these little worms, so they're about 300 microns thick.
Oh, wow.
So that's a few hairs width, let's say, but about
a lot more like a cell than...
Very, 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 very thin worm. But about 10 to 40 millimetres long, okay? And so these were living worms.
Mm.
And what they would do, they'd put them down a column, down this column, but they wanted to see whether it made any difference whether the worms were moving or not.
Mm-hmm.
And so they got them drunk.
Yes.
Okay.
Well,
they got half of them drunk, and that made them immobile.
Immobile, okay? Yes. They're relaxed.
And what they found was basically that the immobile worms took longer to get through this passage of confined spaces, which is basically what it is, than did the ones that were mobile, because
that makes
they
sense.
Could wiggle their way
wiggling
through
a little bit.
These confined spaces much more easily than the ones that couldn't move, okay? And so therefore they then sort of... relate this now to separating polymers and stuff.
Yep.
So polymers where basically the molecules are more mobile, they can more easily bend and stretch and all those sorts of things, should be separated from molecules that can't do that, more rigid molecules.
Right.
And again, you know, that's all good stuff.
Mm.
second last, the demography prize. Demography prize from workers in Australia and the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the reference is super centenarians and the oldest old are concentrated into regions with no birth certificates and short lifespans.
Right. So,
I remember when I was a kid growing up and we'd always hear stories about Georgia, not Georgia, America, Georgia,
Georgia, the country,
And there are all these people that live to 150 years old and that, you know, it's just this, it was basically Shangri-La pretty much.
Right.
You know, you'd live as long as...
Yeah.
And there's places in the world that do have that reputation. Three of these are Sardinia and Okinawa and a Greek island called Ikaria.
Yeah, I feel like whenever you hear about the oldest person on Earth, it's not someone who lives in New York, right? It'll be someone who lives in some village in the middle of nowhere.
Yes, exactly. And that's exactly what they found out, that these supposed long-lived people from these three places... these three places just happen to have, as I said before, no birth certificates and generally usually quite short lifespans rather than long lifespans, okay?
They just appeared to be old.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yes, relatively speaking, I guess. So there's one for you. So, you know, if you hear about sort of old age, you know, do a bit of research and just check and see if they... did have the birth certificates and stuff.
Yeah, not necessarily verifiable.
You could make a fantastic conspiracy theory out of this.
Oh.
Did you know that not having a birth certificate makes you live longer?
Oh, that's so true. That's so true.
And finally, here we go, the biology prize from the USA.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the reference, very, very boring name, factors involved in the ejection of milk. Very, very boring.
Oh, okay. Yes. Yeah.
So what they did was they got a cow... and they got a cat, and they got a paper bag.
No.
And they put the cat on the cow, and then they blew up the paper bag with air, and then they'd pop the paper bag with air, the cat would probably go on the cow.
Yep.
And what they found, that the cows released less milk when startled.
Mm.
Okay, and this is all the way back from the Journal of Dairy Science in 1941.
Right, yeah. So I was trying to figure out, is this a modern study where they're putting cats on cows? That makes more sense.
There has to have been a way to startle cows without cat-based pain.
I suppose it does, you can do it remotely, right? If you pop the bag over here, the cat will still hear it.
Yeah, true. But, you know, as I say, each of those examples that I've gone through, they are all science.
Yeah.
Proper science. They've all been published in internationally recognised journals, peer-reviewed journals. And, yeah, so first of all, they do make you laugh, and then they make you think.
Yeah, wow. You know,
because people had the idea to do this stuff because they were trying to solve a scientific question.
And there's thousands more just like them that got submitted.
Yes.
Wow.
So there will be a batch next year, so we will wait for then.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
It's almost a shame because they're so interesting once you get past the, like, incredibly dry and dense article titles. I almost want scientific articles to have clickbait headlines so that I can understand what's going on.
Oh, so that's a thing. That's a thing.
Oh, yeah. Yes, we get clickbait science article headlines.
Yeah.
That's really good. Maybe they're no better than the rest of us.
I don't know about that, Justin.
All right. Well, we'll be wrapping up Dear Science here. Thank you, Alan, for coming in and sharing the Ig Nobel Prize top 10. That was incredible. Thank you, Moshe, as well. And thank you, Science. We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the bee.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.